yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today, as promised last week, we're going to address the question of financial bubbles, financial asset price bubbles, and financial fragility, financial instability in the global market. You know, these things, bubbles and instability, tend to grow even as it looks like the non-financial markets, the non-financial part of the economy is doing well. And it's kind of like a calm before the storm. The better it seems it is doing, the more likely it's going to, in the near future, reverse. And, of course, we see these big bubbles everywhere, don't we? The stock bubble just keeps going and going. That's not the only financial market that's of import here, and we'll talk about some of those. But first, I want to say a few things about the job numbers, U.S. employment numbers that have just been reported today. Okay, so we've got this job numbers comes out first Friday of every month, and the job numbers show a 33,000 job decline. Well, of course, that has to do with the hurricanes. Yes. In restaurant employment alone, 104,000 jobs were lost just in restaurants. Well, I don't know. Were there that many restaurant workers in South Florida and in Texas? I don't know. Maybe. And it might also be a portention of people pulling back a little bit on discretionary expenditures. Well, we don't know that, but we do know 100,000 jobs were lost in restaurants, and of course that had something to do, retail too, I'm sure, significantly affected, and manufacturing, at least in Texas, significantly affected by the hurricanes. Okay, we admit that, right? However, people should keep in mind that the trend was slowing significantly even before the hurricanes. The numbers for August, job numbers for August, were revised down, jobs created in August before the hurricane, revised down by over 50,000 jobs, running, according to the revised numbers, August job creation was about 138,000 instead of 190,000. All right, so that's been going on throughout the summer, this drifting lower. And if you look at 2016, the average number of jobs created were 193,000. And if you look at 2015, the average monthly job creation was 226. So we're going from 226 to 193 to clearly averaging less than 150 this year. Now, we're probably going to see a bounce back next month. We won't see a minus 33. There'll be a bounce back. And then, of course, we have the Christmas holidays where a lot of part-time people or temp people are hired. But I predict after the first of the year, we're going to see a big reversal in the jobs numbers. Now, a lot of that depends upon whether there will be some kind of infrastructure spending bill. And that depends upon the tax bill. Tax bill has nothing, tax cuts have nothing to do with creating jobs, but infrastructure might. And the infrastructure legislation is waiting upon the tax legislation, which in turn is waiting upon the deficit extension legislation by Congress. which is in the works right now, in parallel with the tax cut stuff. Well, we talked about the tax cut in great detail last week. For those who would want a more succinct and detailed summary of my analysis of the Trump-Goldman Sachs tax legislation proposals of last week, I would simply direct you to my blog, jackrasmus.com, where my recently, the last few days, published article, print version, has appeared. And also, or you could go to Counterpunch or ZNet or Telesur. This has appeared in a number of places, or the World Financial Review. Any of those online, you can read it as well. It's the same topic about the Bush-Goldman Sachs tax cuts. And if you didn't listen to it last week, you can listen to it podcast here on the Progressive Radio Network as well. Okay, so that's the tax legislation waiting on the deficit debt. Now they're going to pass the deficit debt extension, no doubt, and because without that, they can't go ahead with the tax legislation. And the tax legislation is really what they want, particularly the corporate tax measures, where they're going to reduce the corporate nominal tax rate from 35-20%. And turn all corporations into hedge funds as far as tax payments is concerned. Carried interest is 20%. So, you know, instead of raising the carried interest to 35%, they're going to reduce every corporation to hedge fund status. You know, the hedge funds get this big boondoggle called carried interest, where they pay pay taxes on their profits, the hedge fund profits, as if they were paying individual income tax at 20% instead of paying a corporate rate. Well, that's a big loophole. But instead of closing that loophole, what they're doing is reducing the tax for all the corporations. And then, of course, the other biggies for the corporate tax dodge here in this legislation is ending the territorial tax, as they call it. They claim that U.S. multinational corporations pay double, unlike other countries, right? So they pay the 35% here, allegedly nominal rate, and they pay foreign taxes in foreign countries as well. And that's called the territorial tax. Well, that's just BS, right? First of all, corporations and multinationals don't pay 35% nominal rate here. What they pay is about 12 to 13% nominal rate, effective rate, after all their loopholes, you see. And the big loopholes are offshore inversions, tax inversions, and different gimmicks. And there's this foreign profits tax, which they don't pay, and Congress doesn't chase them on that much. So they just stuff all their money offshore. Well, we talked about that last week in their subsidiaries. They stuff it so they don't have to pay taxes anywhere. You know, Apple, $260 billion in cash, 95% is held in their offshore subsidiary, so they don't have to pay cash. Well, they're going to eliminate that altogether, and of course what that means is that we got a big incentive for corporations to stuff more into their offshore subsidiaries to avoid paying tax, because they won't have to pay tax on that anymore, you see. They'll engage in what's called intercorporate pricing, shifting the money around so the profits appear offshore rather than onshore, even though they were earned onshore. That's a big gimmick. So they're going to eliminate that. That's where the big corporate freebie is going to be. And also a freebie with this so-called repatriation tax. I talked about that last week, where companies like Apple will be able to bring it back at 10% instead of 35%, you see, 10% before the tax lawyers take a whack at it. So pay a couple percent, maybe, bring it back, and they'll give the big cover. Congress will give the big cover saying, oh, they're going to bring it back to create jobs. Well, they played that game in 2005 under George W. Bush. brought back $300 billion, and they didn't use it for jobs. They used it for mergers, acquisitions, buying up competitors, paying out dividends, buying back their stock, boosting the bubble in the stocks in 2005-06, right? They're going to do the same thing again. They got away with it once. They're going to do it again. Well, those are the biggies, the corporate tax. There's some talk about these committees in Congress maybe tweaking the other major elements to pay for the big corporate tax giveaway, you know, the business income for non-corporate companies, that's called the income pass-through. They're going to have to maybe take a whack at that and adjust it a little bit. And then the personal income tax, the big freebies are not the reduction in the corporate income tax nominal rate, 39.635. That's not the biggie. The biggie is eliminating the inheritance tax and the alternative minimum tax. That's where these wealthy 1% are going to get the big deal. And we'll see how that turns out. That whole personal income tax, the third element of this Trump tax proposal, will get some reworking as well. You're not going to see much reworking on that corporate income tax. And even Trump himself gave a signal. He said, look, you know, the most important thing I want is the corporate tax. And second thing is something for the middle class, you know, a little taste. Well, what does he mean, the middle class? He doesn't mean 90,000 and below. You know, he means the folks up there, 150 to 400. That's what he calls the middle class. And anyway, we'll see how that turns out. But, you know, my point was we're going to have to see what the deficit extension, which will happen, and then the tax cuts, which will happen, and then whether we're going to see infrastructure happen next year. I doubt it. Okay. It'll be real estate wheeling dealing deals. That's what they'll call infrastructure. Okay, back to the job numbers here before we get on to financial fragility. Job numbers. Yes, we have 100,000 restaurant workers' jobs lost because of the hurricane, 33,000 official net job loss. That will bounce back a little bit next month, then the Christmas, and then we'll see what happens after the first of the year. I think the whole economy is going to slow down in 2018. And as before, you know, I've been predicting a recession in the U.S. late 2018-19. The economy will get a little boost because of government spending here that will occur in the wake of these hurricanes. So government spending, aid, and so forth will give the economy a little bit more boost that I hadn't been anticipating in my prediction 2018. So the recession may come really in 19, but it still could be the end of 18. We'll see. What happens there. But the job numbers, you know, were weakening before. As I noted, you know, the trend has been significantly down. We are really just treading water here in terms of job creation to absorb people entering the workforce if you're at 138,000. Okay. Incredibly, you could have a loss of 33,000 jobs, and the unemployment rate went down from 4.4 to 4.2. It just shows you how worthless that unemployment rate is, because that unemployment rate is the way they calculate it. I won't go into details, but it's really on full-time employment, you see, full-time workers. And we have over 60 million people who are part-time contract work, involuntary temp work, on call, etc. This is the new workforce, you see. Out of the 161 million people in the labor force, at least 60 million of those are not regular employed full-time people anymore. Well, this unemployment rate of 4.2% ignores them altogether, you see. based on full-time unemployment, is 6.8 million people still unemployed in the U.S. Ah, but you've got to add 5.1 million involuntary part-time to that number. And that brings the total to about 12 million. Not 6.8 million, 4.2% is 12 million. And then they have what's called marginal workers, marginal labor force, discouraged workers, and so forth, which they estimate, the government, at 1.6 million. So 12 million, 11.9 million, 12 million, 1.6 million, that's 13.5 million who are really unemployed. Not 6.8, 13.5. And that brings us, almost to 9% unemployment. The numbers are actually, for unemployed, larger than that. My estimates are it's not 9 million unemployed. It's probably around 12, 13 million unemployed. It's not 13.5 million unemployed. It's really, I would say, another 2 to 3 million unemployed. So we're well in excess of 15 million unemployed in this country, right? And that's not counting... Where did all these folks go in the labor force? In other words, all these calculations, the numbers I just gave, does not include the fact that the labor force, as a percentage of non-institutional potential workers, is... at 63%. It was, before the crisis, at 68%. All right, so 5% disappeared. 5% of the labor force disappeared. Where did he go? All right? And if you're talking about 5% of 160 million, that's another 8 million. So if we, based on my prior calculations of 15, 16 million actual, if you add another 8 million, there's about 25 million people who are effectively jobless, and that should be the definition of unemployed, or who gave up on finding work, or who never entered the labor force, or are somewhere working in the underground economy, and aren't being picked up, the real total unemployed in this country is 20, 25 million. It's not 6.8 million. It's 20, 25 million. Unemployed, underemployed, together here. There was an interesting article that came out in the New York Times here to give you a reflection of this. That I'm talking about, entitled "The Lasting Scar of Recession, 1.5 million Workers Vanish." Well, they're only talking about workers in the 25 to 64 age bracket. That 1.5 million does not include those under 25, nor those over 64. And we know we have a big increase in employment over 64. People can't afford to retire at 64, 65. And even by the New York Times calculation, we're talking about 3 to 4 million who vanish. What's going on here? These numbers they tell you about employed, unemployed, they're only approximations. When you look at... other forces and factors involved here, like labor force participation rate and vanishing workforce and their underestimation of discouraged workers and so forth, the numbers are much bigger. Even Larry Summers in this article, quote, says that the 2008 recession pushed people out of the economy, but recovery did not bring them all back, unquote. Well, the question is why? Why haven't they come back? Well, you got this Princeton economist who I forget his name. He says, "Oh, the reason is that they're all junkies now." In other words, that they the opioid epidemic here explains why they haven't come back. The opioid epidemic, you know. So somehow everyone got hooked on fentanyl or something here since 2008. Right? Now, it is true that we have had a 2 million increase in folks going on Social Security disability, SSDI. That's true, because they've figured out, it's a better guaranteed, better paid form of unemployment insurance. So I'm not saying that everybody on SSDI since 2008 is in that category, but, you know, come on. You know, workers can be clever when they need to. And, yes, there are folks on SSDI. That's increased significantly, 2 million. By the way, that number, 2 million, doesn't get included anywhere in the employment, unemployment rate or anything. That's people who aren't working but aren't unemployed, you see, because unemployment has a very narrow conservative definition in the U.S., All right, so are they all on opioids here, you know? the 1.5, probably 3 million missing that they talk about, you know? Or maybe the 8 million who aren't involved in the labor force now, on top of our official 13.5, and I say 16 million, 8 million. The labor force participation rate disappeared, and even as a subset of that, for workers 25-64, this article talks about the missing. Well, as ridiculous as it is to say it's the opioid crisis, I think in Princeton, the other academics at the University of Chicago, actually, I can't believe this, but I'm, you know, this is what they said. They said, "Oh, people are just staying home playing video games." Can you believe that? University of Chicago, I mean, academics are so bankrupt when it comes to explaining what's going on. Yeah, they're playing video games, right? Other economists say, well, people are just retiring early. You know, that's why we have this big 5% gap in the labor force participation rate. We've got an aging population, and they're retiring early. Or they're saying, well, they were out too long of the labor force, the workforce, because of the recession, and their skills have become stale, and they can't, really qualify for the new jobs that are moving fast, kind of a thing, right? So that's one another explanation, aging or been out too long, a little bit more credible than playing video games or on opioids. Well, there's other explanations here that I think are more credible, you know. One is the wages are too low. You know, for a lot of jobs, it costs more to actually go to work than you get. You know, I mean, if you got child care or if you got to commute real far, and the price of gas and all these other costs that have gone up, but the wages haven't gone up. So, you know, why would anyone go to work when it costs them more to work than they would get, you see? I think there's a number of people in that category here. I think a number of them may be working in the underground economy. What that simply means is that it's temp and part-time, and those numbers, temp and part-time numbers, at 1.6 million, are ridiculously low, the official numbers, right? If some of these people are working underground, they're not working full-time. Right. And then, of course, the 2 million SSDI. But a lot of the jobs have been lost to offshoring in the meantime. Yeah. This offshoring thing has really actually picked up steam here since 2010. And more jobs have been moving offshore. It's been accelerating in manufacturing and in non-manufacturing even. And then the other
legitimate reason, I think, is that employers are replacing jobs since the recession with capital equipment, machinery, technology. You know? Those are the real reasons why, much more credible, but yet the academics run around talking about people being hooked on drugs and playing video games and, oh, they're just retiring early. I don't know too many people retiring early. I know a lot of people who are extending their work because they can't afford to retire early. All right? Okay. Another thing that is obvious, it's called what's called sometimes jobless recessions. If you look at the 12 recessions since 1947 in this country, a jobless recession is how long it takes from the beginning of the recession and the jobs, of course, are lost during the course of the recession. How long does it take to get the job level back up where it was on the eve of the recession? How many months? Right? Officially, recessions are defined, absurdly, I think, by the National Bureau of Economic Research economist. When the economy stops falling, it may still be negative, but it stops falling, that's the end of the recession, you see. So the last recession began in December 2007 and officially ended, according to NBR economists, in June 2009. Well, the economy was pretty damn weak for quite some time. But officially, in terms of GDP and other economic indicators that the NBER looks at, it was over in June 2009. Well, it wasn't over in terms of jobs, you see, because for a couple of years more, we kept losing jobs every month. And it has taken, it's taken about, I don't know, 80, 84 months to get back to a level of jobs that we had at the commencement of that recession in 2007. Yes, it's taken like 7 years, 6 to 7 years. Well, when we started looking at recessions in 1947, 48, it was like 3 to 6 months. And then in the 1970s, it was 6 to 9 months to get back to the level of jobs. And then in the 80s, it was like 24 months. And it's been rising, 36 months. In the 90s, under George Bush, was 48 months in 2001 recession. And then it almost doubles, 2008. So we have this trend going on of every time we have a recession, it takes longer and longer to bring the jobs back, you see. Plus, the jobs that do come back are low-quality, low-pay jobs, contingent jobs, part-time jobs, and so forth. That's another phenomenon. Each time there's a cycle, the jobs simply don't recover quantitatively as quickly, and more importantly, the recovery in terms of the quality of jobs is declining as well. Okay, so that's what I have to say about the numbers here. The numbers, reported job numbers today, you know, sum up, yes, we lost some jobs, but we've been slowing the job growth for 2.5 years now, and that will pick up next year as well. And we still have 8 million people who dropped out, never entered the labor force. That should be added to the 15 million at least. Officially acknowledged unemployed, and then they're finally beginning to acknowledge this in the press, you know, with this 1.5 million vanished for a segment of the labor force of the employed. But then, you know, we have these absurd economists talking about, through their, you know what, about the causes. You know, I mean, these guys aren't stupid. They know that's not the cause, but they're well paid to cover up the real causes, you see. They don't dare answer the real causes. They'll talk about the numbers, but when it comes to the causes, they won't talk about it, you know. They can't. Or, you know, they'll lose their relationships with the corporate media and others, so they, and maybe even the, you know, their positions in their academic sinecures. Okay. Have to say that about the jobs, first half of the show. Let's move on to what I had promised last week that we would start talking about, and that's bubbles, financial fragility, and bubbles. Okay. In my early 2016 book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, that was addressed to the shift that's going on into financial assets instead of real assets that create real jobs for real people. Financial assets generate price-driven financial securities, inflation, and bubbles, and make big, quick profits, financial profits for their investors, you see. It's much more profitable now, and we have to invest, investors to put their money in the financial markets, because the speculation going on in financial asset markets is driven by the central banks, ultimately, by providing all this free money. And that, of course, was the topic of my just-produced book, Here, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes. You can find out more of that on my blog as well, jackrasmus.com, or go to claritypress.com /Rasmus, and they will give you information about it. Or you can just buy it and look at the reviews on Amazon or wherever. But the two books are linked. You know, the first book is really about why we have the bubbles. And the bubbles, of course, when they crash, as they did in 2008-09, bring down the whole economy, the real economy, with them. And then the central banks step in and bail out the banks and the speculators. And we've talked about that in previous shows, how the central banks, major central banks of the world, have spent, you know, $15 to $25 trillion, 25 if you include China, which is becoming more and more like other central banks. In fact, they just announced another boost to liquidity. In other words, liquidity is what banks and investors borrow from the central banks and then turn around and lend it to investors and speculators who, you know, buy financial securities. And, of course, the private banks do it as well as lend to others to do it. And that's what's been going on here, feeding the new financial bubbles. So the financial crash create, you know, the financial speculation bubbles, you know, in housing and in derivatives and a whole bunch of other things at 2008-09, you know, that precipitates the financial crash. The financial crash freezes up the banks. The banks don't loan, freezes up the rest of the real economy. The rest of the real economy starts laying off people in massive amounts and starts experiencing losses, which then reflect on the banks who have loaned them money or other investors who have bought their bonds. And that just exacerbates the financial side, which becomes a vicious downward cycle, you see. That was systemic fragility on a global economy. Well, the central banks cause it, ultimately, by pumping all the free money into their banking buddies. And they are buddies, no doubt about it. You know, you got revolving doors going on at the Federal Reserve Bank, the central bank of the U.S., you know, in and out of the banking industry, and all these reforms from the Depression have no effect anymore. You know, we'll soon see Goldman Sachs running the Federal Reserve, probably, here in 2018, as well as running the U.S. Treasury. Already, the New York Federal Reserve is run by a Goldman Sachser, Bill Dudley. In any event, you know, they got a nice system where it looks like the banks don't really run the central bank, the Federal Reserve, but indirectly they still do, either through the government, through these key agencies, or the fact is the majority of the federal districts of the Federal Reserve Bank, there's 12 districts, you know, are pretty much, the majority of them are pretty much in the hands of the bankers. The bankers get to fulfill 6 of the 9 seats, so they always have a majority. And the presidents of the districts get to vote on the open market committee that determines interest rates and quantitative easing and so forth. And there's supposed to be 7 independent governors, according to 1930 reforms, you know, to leaving out that 12 district presidents. So it's supposed to be 19, but, you know, those governors don't last very long. They get picked off and they go work for banks, or they go back to academia, one or the other. All right, so now I think we only have 3 or 4 of the 7 positions actually being filled. So there's like 3 or 4 of the governors who aren't there. You know, they're supposed to have 14-year terms, but they only serve on average 2 to 3 years. That's because they go into this role and then they go work for a big bank, see, revolving doors. That's one, another way. Yeah, but by controlling the presidents of the districts and, you know, enticing the governors to join them at big bucks, and then working their influence through Congress on the key committees and in Treasury and so forth. This is how the banks control the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve pumps all this money into the economy that gets borrowed by the banks, free money. Even though they've been raising it a little bit, you know, I mean, what's 1.25%? I'd like to borrow at 1.25%. Well, that's what the banks get from the government, from the central bank. Yeah, that's what they get. And for 8 years, they got less than 1.15% money, all the free money they want, right? And so much free money. Far more than they could loan out to invest in real goods and services that hire people, make things, right? So all this excess money has been going into financial assets, into securities, financial securities. And, of course, it's the main reason why we see the U.S. stock market now at really bubble levels. Yeah. You know, the last rung of the run-up here, after more than tripling, in the case of the S&P 500, you know, the last rung here is since Trump's come in. It's called the Trump trade. And, you know, stocks are up another, 13% since the beginning of this year? Yeah. And there's no fundamental reason. I mean, it's not that, you know, these companies are doing so much better and so forth. It's just that there's so much money on the sidelines here, trillions and trillions of dollars provided by the Fed and other central banks over the years, especially since 2008. There's so much money, and 3/4 of all the investment in the markets are by institutionals like hedge funds and so forth. They got to keep the money moving. So every time there's a little contraction, the stock market never gets to contract back down to its real level. The money flows back in again, and it drives it back up. And that's what we've got. And, you know, we in the NASDAQ stock market in the U.S. is really driven by maybe 6 or so companies, you know, called the FANGs, right? Facebook, Alphabet, i.e. Google, right? Amazon, Netflix, and Google, right? The FANGs, they call them, right? They're driving. And the same in the Dow. It's just big companies, big multinationals. And, of course, the whole prospect of these big tax cuts and all this additional money being given or kept. You know, you can keep more money. We're funneling all this money to the central bank. Now the Congress and the tax system is going to say, you can keep it more. Well, what are they going to do with that? They're going to turn around, and they're investing it already in the stock market. The bubble's going higher. Instead of the Federal Reserve providing the free money, stimulating the markets, now corporations are going to keep more of all that you've made and were given, and you can use that to invest in the stock markets too, right? Well, that's why we got the bubbles going in U.S. stocks. But there's other bubbles as well, right, to watch. What are they? Well, what's called junk bonds. That's also caused ultimately by the central bank with very, very low interest rates. Companies have simply issued record levels of corporate bonds because the interest rate is so cheap. You know, the bond interest rates, private bond interest rates, will follow the federal rates, central bank determined driven rates. And if that's, you know, less than a quarter of a percent, then issuing bonds is going to be very, very cheap for corporations. And that means that corporations that should have gone under or should not have been given new loans are able, in other words, they're in fragile condition economically, they're able to extend their life by issuing what's called junk bonds, high yield, high interest rate junk bonds. So you've got a lot of companies that should have been flushed out here over the last 8 years that are in bad shape, that are able to continue because of the ability to issue junk bonds, you see. And that's a sector that's very fragile here. Energy, small energy producers, frackers, and so forth. Retail, we're beginning to see signs of the retail industry and sector in deep, deep trouble here. Next recession, goodbye Sears, probably goodbye Penny's, and a bunch of others, I predict. So junk bonds. And the junk bond train continues to roll even in Europe. You see, the junk bonds are, the rates are so cheap in Europe, they're almost at the same level of U.S. 10-year treasuries, which is about 2.25, right? That means the prices, because prices move in opposite direction of rates, the prices of junk bonds in Europe are in a bubble. So watch out for junk bonds in a bubble in Europe and junk bonds in a bubble in certain industries in the U.S. Because when the contraction comes, something precipitates it, right? It's barred the door because those bond prices are going to collapse. Mm-hmm. So we got the U.S. stock market that's over stimulated, and we got the junk bond market, U.S. and in Europe. There's something also called the leverage loan market, and this is where shadow banks like private equity companies continue to loan out for mergers and acquisition purposes more and more liquidity, right? And in order to loan it out, they reduce what's called the covenants. The covenants are conditions of the loan, so they make it easier and easier to borrow for mergers and acquisition purposes. Leveraged buyouts, right? Put the money up because there's so much money to put up available. Mm-hmm. By what I mean by covenants is that when you have strong covenants, it means that, okay, if you're in bad shape as a company, you can't refinance or something. But covenant light conditions, which are now, means that, we'll just loan you some more if you're in trouble, see? The Bank of International Settlements quarterly publication just recently raised a red flag about these cov-lite deals that are occurring, right? And companies are allowed to borrow more to pay debt on what they already borrowed, you see, leveraged. And the same thing's happened with junk bonds. Leveraging is increasing. Now, a third area would consider a risky area is what's called exchange-traded funds, or ETFs. ETFs in stocks, ETFs in bonds, right? What this is average retail investors and even institutionals are just buying into these funds, exchange-traded funds, which are just gatherings of stocks or bonds, or stocks and bonds and other things. And they're not invested in individual companies. They're just plowing their money into these ETFs and managed by shadow bankers and retail investors. You know, that's a way of I don't want to pick this or that company. I'm just going to ride with the index, with the average for an industry or stocks or bonds or something like that. So a lot of people are plowing into ETFs. Now, the problem is if it's all tied up in ETFs and what's called passive investment, once these stock and bond markets begin and leveraged loan markets begin contracting, they're not going to be able to get out, you see. They're not going to be able to get their money out. They're not going to be able to sell when the reversal and contraction occurs. They're going to be stuck, and the price is just going to fall. And that will exacerbate the fear factor and exacerbate the financial asset price collapses in general. ETFs, big problem area. Okay, what about digital currencies? Boy, is this a bubble. I'm talking about Bitcoin, right, and Ethereum, and all the IPOs. In other words, speculators offering to buy, to sell, rather, interest, stock, shares in Bitcoin and, you know, Ethereum and others, right? Cryptocurrencies, as they're called. How many pending or actual IPOs for different kinds of cryptocurrencies are there? 1,100. 1,100. Whoa. You know, this is running amok. This is you know, it's not a big part of the global financial economy, but it's pure speculation. Meaning, well, you know, I'm going to buy Bitcoin because I think the price is going to rise, and of course it has significantly in 2017. It's a sign of the frothing and the bubbles that are multiplying everywhere. And China, by the way, has put the nicks on Bitcoin, saying, ooh, this is even too dangerous, you know, and, you know, they're trying to scale back any participation in Bitcoin. But then you got Japan that is trying to, you know, expand Bitcoin. Bank of Japan policies are designed, and Japan has given, you know, the green light to Bitcoins and cryptocurrencies. You know, the Japanese were the first to really engage in this speculation, super speculation in the modern period in the late 80s and 90s, and of course it collapsed their economy. Apparently they haven't learned a lesson, you know, Japanese. Well, you know, the Japanese Central Bank is the worst among the central banks in terms of pumping liquidity into the economy. In the U.S., the Federal Reserve, you know, was buying treasury bonds from private investors called quantitative easing, and also mortgage bonds, of course, buying up those toxic mortgage bonds, probably higher than market prices, subsidizing the investors in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And in Europe, it's not just government bonds they've been buying, European Central Bank, but corporate bonds as well. You know, at least in the U.S., they weren't buying corporate bonds. In Europe, they were. But Japan outdoes them all. Japan's buying stocks and other crazy securities. Yeah, the central bank is just propping up the investors and driving up investor prices and speculation in order to, you know, provide super profits for those speculators and investors. So, you know, Japan is way out there, Japan government and investors, in experimenting with the fragile financial products of various kinds. And that's all the Bitcoin and digital currencies are. You know, that's just a pure speculative play. Drive up prices and make capital gains on, you know, something that's essentially worthless. It doesn't mean anything. Look, Bitcoin's digital tulips. That's what they are, the digital tulips. Remember the tulip craze in the 1640s in Holland, right? They were buying tulip bulbs simply because the next day they'd sell it for more. You know, they weren't worth that, and the price of tulip bulbs went way up, and then a crash occurred, it always does, and it wrecked the Dutch economy at least for a decade, maybe even longer. And, of course, that always happens when you get this massive speculation, and it crashes, it brings down the rest of the economy. Well, we got this thing, digital currencies, that are out of control here, and the Federal Reserve doesn't know how to gain control of it, because it's a form of money, you see, but a form of money that the speculative money, investment money, oh, they say it's for transactions too, but it's really about speculative money. And the Federal Reserve doesn't know how to get its hands around it to regulate it. Now, you're not going to regulate it. It's all up there in technology and the Internet, right? Very, very hard to regulate. Okay, so digital currencies, another problem, another weak, fragile area of the economy. How about Europe, right? The debt levels in the periphery of Europe, periphery meaning the southern periphery, you know, Italy, and you know, Italy, Greece, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, and so forth, right, was a big problem here not too long ago. It still is a lingering problem, but the bigger problem is non-performing bank loans in Europe. A couple trillion dollars, maybe. By the way, a couple trillion in Japan, too, right? Big problem, NPLs. And Italy, of course, is the biggest problem right now. We're looking at, you know, several trillion dollars. The European Central Bank is trying to get its hands around this, you know, trying to clean it up, but they're having a hard time cleaning it up. The situation is so bad in Italy that it was just reported that the government is no longer paying its civil servants, its public workers, with euros. How are they getting paid? Oh, with tax credits. Yeah, in other words, if you work for the government, they will tell you, you will get a tax credit here. You won't have to pay so much in your taxes, and that's equivalent to the wages you would have gotten. Right? It's a form of what we call scrip, S-C-R-I-P, scrip, you know. And whenever there's a financial crisis, local governments have always had, including in the United States, a lack of currency, a lack of money available, because they can't collect taxes, you know, everything's so bad. So what they do is issue their own, quote, emergency form of currency. It's called scrip. That's been done in the U.S. several times. Well, Italy's doing right now, and it's an indication of the instability and the fragility of what's going on. And don't underestimate the political instability. It looks like the U.K. Brexit effort is floundering. You know, the longer they delayed the Brexit, the better chance the opposition to Brexit, which means the big banks in London, had of reversing it. And the Conservative Party there, the Tory Party there, is really blowing it. And, you know, my prediction is there won't be a real Brexit. By the time this thing happens, right? They will have checked it. But we have instability now in Spain, right? With Catalonia going to take a vote to leave Spain. And, of course, you know, the Spanish government, arrogant SOBs, try to send SWAT teams to stop the vote here last week. What a dumb move. I can't believe how dumb some of these government people are. You know, this guy Rajoy, whatever his name is, you know, I mean, to send SWAT teams to stop a vote, I mean, that's pretty stupid. You know, you can guarantee that's going to blow up in your face, and of course it did. Mm-hmm. And now we don't know what's going to happen with Catalonia. Maybe a lot of instability in Spain in the coming period ahead. Mm-hmm. And who knows where this populism thing has not, which takes a nationalist kind of a reflection, you see. And, of course, it's done that in the U.S., this, you know, economic nationalism, you know, by Bannon and Breitbart and Trump. That's a reflection of a kind of right-wing populism, which is really a challenge to the ruling elites, you see. Well, that's going to continue to go on in Europe. That's not changing. Okay, so what are some of the other problems apart from non-performing bank loans? Well, if you look at emerging markets, more and more debt in emerging markets has been written in dollars. Dollarized debt, they call it. $11 trillion in dollarized debt since 2009. $11 trillion. Well, why is that significant? Well, because once interest rates rise in the U.S., the ability to pay that debt, refinance that debt, is going to get more difficult for emerging markets. Right now they're on a boomlet because the dollar has been low, but the dollar will rise. And when that happens, problems in emerging markets with dollarized debt are going to emerge. Okay, what else? What's another area of probable instability? Well, the Bank of International Settlements issued a report saying, well, there's $14 trillion in non-bank debt that's been hidden globally in emerging markets. $14 trillion. Well, what do we mean hidden debt? You know, it's not loans, it's not bonds, or, you know, what is it? Well, according to the BIS, Bank of International Settlements in Geneva, which has been for some time warning about debt, excess debt, and the accumulation of tens of trillions more since 2009, particularly in the private sector, you see, because it's not government debt that's the problem. The problem's always private debt. And it's not household debt, it's business debt. And it's financial business debt and non-bank business debt. Well, $14 trillion has been hidden. How do they hide it? Well, they just invest the debt or change its nomination to foreign derivative holdings. They invest it in foreign derivatives. The technique there, I'm not totally aware of how they do that, but. Basically, it's what's called foreign exchange swaps, you know, find a kind of derivative. That market of foreign exchange swaps is $58 trillion worldwide, right? Three-fourths of global GDP, which is about $78 trillion, equivalent, you know. Foreign exchange currency, foreign exchange derivative holdings are a way of avoiding reporting debt. Okay. Well, next week we're going to look at a Deutsche Bank study about all this. Deutsche Bank, the big investment bank in Germany. And they're the ones who have said, we've got problems brewing in the global economy. All right, so we'll talk about that next week. This is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.